Welcome to the CME presentation entitled Advances in the Understanding and Treatment of Obesity. I'm Dr. Christopher Still, Medical Director for the Center for Nutrition and Weight Management at Geisinger Medical Center in Danville, Pennsylvania. I'm pleased to be joined with two colleagues of mine, Jamie Seiler, Physician Assistant within the Center for Nutrition and Weight Management, and Tasha Dersham, Registered Dietitian, also within the center. After today's presentation, it is our hope that you'll be more comfortable with treating patients struggling with the disease of obesity and provide more treatment options for them, whether medical or surgical. If we ask ourselves why all the interest in obesity treatment, I break it down into basically three things. Number one, I believe obesity, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the most important healthcare crisis affecting America today. The other one is the new management we have, both in the treatment, but also exciting things for prevention, especially in children and adolescents, which is a huge problem. And third, and unfortunately, the epidemic of obesity. If we look at the NHANES data, we can see that up until about 1980, the incidence of individuals that were overweight and obese remained quite stable. From 1980 on, there's been a significant increase in individuals that are both overweight and obese. And in the gray columns, you can see those are the individuals that are overweight. And in the green columns, those are the ones that are considered obese. And we'll talk about the definitions in just a minute. But the most important thing is that despite our best intentions of this obesity epidemic, there's been a significant increase in individuals that are overweight. Tasha, as a dietitian, what do you think is the problem, or what are we doing wrong that has accounted for this significant epidemic over the last 25 years?
I think there are a number of reasons. We have essentially a toxic environment where it's hard to eat healthy with the advent of supersizing and large portions and more sedentary lifestyles with technology and things that are around. And also convenience of foods that are just everywhere. And so often now you pick up a box of food versus preparing it from scratch. Mm-hmm. And there's also the issue of families not eating at home much anymore. We have busy lifestyles, and it seems as if more calories are consumed outside of the home, which tends to be obviously higher caloric density foods.
Yeah, I heard a statistic that 51 cents of every dollar is spent that is spent on food is purchased outside of the home. Mm-hmm. So really, we don't have any control of what we're eating in the caloric density of those, as you said.
Right.
The other thing that's alarming that's not depicted specifically here, because this is just looking at adults, but children and adolescent obesity is climbing at even a faster rate. And that's very scary because really the prevention we don't have as well as the treatment modalities that we have.
Right.
One thing that is interesting is you recall from 1992 to 1997, their per capita fat decreased. So if it was just a macronutrient problem, we could put in a fat tax and mandate everything has to be a specific percentage of fat. But in fact, from 1992 to 1997, we did decrease the fat per capita individual quite nicely. But why do you think that we still are have the obese problem as we do?
Mm-hmm. With the advent of low-fat diets and low-fat foods on the market, certainly those foods are better options with regards to fat grams per serving, but I think people quickly didn't realize that the foods still contain a large amount of calories, and primarily those calories are coming from sugar or carbohydrate. So people have the idea that you can eat lots of fat-free foods and neglecting to know that the foods are still a significant source of calories.
Yep, because clearly, I mean, despite that, there's been a significant increase.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if we look at the last 25 years, I like to think of things as, where are we going now? And in fact, in 2009, some 73% of us are overweight, and almost 40% of us are obese. I mean, that is an astounding figure. Mm-hmm. And the problem also, which I'm sure everyone will agree, that the fastest growing patient population is the morbid obese. So in the BMI greater than 40, those individuals are growing at a faster rate than the others. And that stands true in adolescents as well, which is very scary because not only the obesity, but all the comorbid medical problems associated with that. So if we look at the four buckets that affected the weight over the last 25 years, I look at it as a food availability and composition. I mean, clearly we eat so much, we have an opportunity to eat so much. And, you know, the fast food industry is not the only reason. But clearly, you know, we're working two jobs, two parents are working, there's all the kids' activities that they're doing, so we're eating out a lot, as we talked about. And so that, I think, not eating as a home, and the composition, it's very cheap. I mean, we can get about 2,500 calories for about $3 or $4 at a fast food restaurant. So I think that is one of the biggest things. The other thing, clearly, is not only the energy intake, but also the energy expenditure. Do you want to talk about what you think has happened in the energy expenditure, Jamie, over the last 25 years?
Sure. As you said, in today's environment, many children live in families where both parents are working, so parents are busy, children are busy, there's less time spent on physical activity. And also, I think a big factor is really technology. Certainly, I think we'd all agree that technology has brought many advances, but it's also made us much more sedentary. Many of us sit in front of a computer, we do our shopping online, we use a remote control to change the television channels. All of these things account for us burning fewer calories during the day. So we have more food available, we're eating more calories or more caloric dense foods, and then we're exercising less mm-hmm. as well. And I think that's contributed to the weight gain and obesity problem that we've seen.
Yeah, a lot of patients think, oh, it's my metabolism. You know, mm-hmm. I have a slow metabolism. But if we look at this schematic on the right, energy expenditure is really broken up into three different types of energy expenditure. There's the resting energy expenditure, which is the predominant energy expenditure that we expend, and that's really determined by our lean body mass. Mm-hmm. Then there's a small percentage of thermogenesis of food, and then that we do increase our metabolic rate or our metabolism when we eat to digest the food. And then finally, what we can and our patients can change is our activities of daily living. So what we can do to increase our metabolism, if you will, by increasing energy expenditure, simply what we're saying about decreasing all the convenient items mm-hmm. that we have. So I think clearly there's an imbalance between the calories we take in and the calories we consume. These are just some examples of the calories that used to be, you know, what was once 280 calories are now 510 calories. You know, what a big thing is the juice and sodas that we take in. I mean, clearly, I don't know what you think, Tasha, but I think with regards to pediatric and adolescent obesity, the empty calories coming from fruit juices and regular sodas are what I call low-hanging fruit. So
right.
I try to have not only children but adults avoid all caloric beverages, whether it's fruit juices or regular soda. And we'll come back to that when we talk about treatment options.
Interestingly, too, the size of the drink, you know, the bigger size generally isn't much more expensive. So
oh, that's the
you
thing.
You get
I
more
mean,
bang
yep.
for your buck, so to speak.
Well, at the local fast food restaurant, no matter what size drink, it's a dollar.
Right.
So, I
right.
mean, why wouldn't you get a big,
right, exactly.
you know,
why
a biggie?
Not?
So. And, you know, the lunch buffets, it's very cheap, you know, mm-hmm. $3.99 for a lunch buffet. Unlimited calories, and people just are not aware.
Sure.
We try to talk to our patients about calories. I think a fundamental issue that people really don't get is the food label. Mm-hmm. And do you want to just talk a few minutes about the food label and what to look at?
Sure. The food label is, it has been helpful for people to educate people, but it can be confusing. We tend to be a people that eat the package versus the portion, and there's certainly a difference between the calories in the entire package versus the calories per serving. So in the slides here, it talks about a serving size being, in this case, a half cup. So there's about 100 calories per half cup. However, if you look more closely, there's four servings in the whole container. So by consuming the entire package of this food, you're consuming 400 calories. But people are easily misled, and they feel that by eating the bag of chips or whatnot, it's only 100 calories.
Yeah,
tricky.
And it's not that they're cheating or, you know, being dishonest. They just don't know, unknowingly do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think with the, you know, the changing of food pyramids, that's helped a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And actually the labels are getting a little easier.
Mm-hmm.
And more. And another thing that I think that has helped is more restaurants are putting the calories on the food sources.
Right.
And I know in New York that's mandated, and hopefully in Pennsylvania that will come soon.
Mm-hmm.
So. I think that is very important. You know, our body is very efficient, and we say, oh, we'll just have a little bit. And, you know, Tasha, do you want to talk about what equals a pound of how many calories equal a pound and what that means?
Sure. Just some basic physiology. A pound of weight is the equivalent of 3,500 calories. So we usually encourage our patients to take their normal intake and decrease their intake by 500 calories. So over the course of 7 days out of the week, therein lies the 3,500 calories. So they would lose approximately a pound a week. And if they're cutting their intake by 1,000 calories a day, they could lose up to 2 pounds a week. So that's just the basics of it.
So I think that's a very good rule about going 500 calories down. It's 3,500 calories in a week, and that's a pound a week or 4 pounds a month. And that, I think that gives the patient some sense of, okay, this is more of a modest weight loss, and hopefully that we can educate them that we'll take small steps, and we'll talk more about that. So what about the people that say, well, I'll just have a little bit, you know, what's, you know, 5 calories a day?
Right.
You know, that's an interesting concept that I didn't really think of, but you want to explain what that?
Sure. It's conversely, you know, it is easy to, we're making it sound easy to lose the weight, but it's so easy to gain the weight. So for instance, an extra 10 calories a day, you could gain up to a pound a year, which again doesn't sound like a lot, but over the course of 10 years could be 10 pounds. So I think as we counsel people in the clinic, we notice that people just, you know, I ask them, well, when did you gain your weight? Well, it just, over the years, it just happened. And I think this explains, you know, how it does just happen.
Yeah, our body is very well regulated. And mm-hmm. as it says, you know, it only takes an extra 10 calories per day to create a 10-pound weight gain in a decade. Mm-hmm. So 10 calories is not much. And all the foods that we have available to us, coupled with the lack of physical activity we do, it's no wonder we have the epidemic of obesity. Mm-hmm. The next area that I think that has affected weight over the last 25 years is appetite. And underneath appetite is mood and stress. You know, clearly, as our body mass index increases, so does the rate of non-suicidal depression. And if you look at the incidence of depression in the normal, in the patient, in the adult population, it's about 9 to 11%. But unfortunately, in the morbidly obese, and we're going to talk about that in just a minute, as a BMI greater than 40, the incidence is double. So it's over 20%. Some people say it's up to 25% in patients that have a BMI greater than 40. Why that's important is because as we become depressed, we self-medicate with food. You know, that is a vicious cycle, specifically carbohydrates. Carbohydrates increase serotonin. That's the neurotransmitter in our brain that gives us that calm and content feeling. So when we're depressed and we're not treated either by medicine, pharmacotherapy, or psychotherapy, we kind of self-medicate with food. The problem is when we take in these carbohydrates, it only lasts about 15 to 20 minutes, and then we go on to that grazing type of mode. So in our practice, as you know, we do the Beck depression on everybody. And if that is high, then we'll consider pharmacotherapy. Like I said, counseling is just as effective if you look. It's just very time-consuming, and a lot of patients don't have the time, and a lot of times their insurance don't cover that. But in our patient population of over 5,000 patients, unfortunately, the number one prescription medication that they're taking is one of the SSRIs for depression. So I think it is important to screen your patients for depression because that will take away a whole eating behavior of self-medicating with food. The next area is metabolism, and underneath metabolism is genetics and medications. Just briefly, genetics, there's been the well-described single-gene deletions for obesity, you know, the Prader-Willi, the Cohen syndrome, the red hair single-gene deletion. But what has not been well-described until recently is the common obesity genes, you know, FTO and INSIG2 that we're doing some work on at the Obesity Research Institute. And I think that's very exciting because we're born with these fat genes, if you will. So if we've shown and other groups have shown that if you have what we call allele burden, so if you have a lot of these alleles from the obesity genes, you tend to be heavier, number one. And what we've shown, and hopefully you're going to publish soon, is that you're more resistant to weight loss after bariatric surgery. So I think that will be helpful because we're born with these genes. So it does hopefully will provide a good treatment. So if we can genotype these kids and say, well, you have a lot of these fat genes, they may be able to be targeted to be more aggressive in not having them become obese, because clearly prevention is much better than treatment.